Are you ready to finally finish that book draft or revision? Are you itching to learn new tools or frameworks to make the writing process easier? Are you looking for a side gig to add to your repertoire? Author Accelerator's Book Coach Certification Program is a robust and exciting way to learn new writing and publishing skills. Their certification course in fiction or nonfiction includes hundreds of hours of video lessons, workshops, and practice exercises, all about researching the marketplace, querying agents, project management for your book idea, and more. They're great, and I say that as someone who's done this. Many writers come to the program looking to up their writing game. Writer and certified book coach Trevor Brooks says, "This course changed my life. I feel more confident than ever in my ability to develop a manuscript as both a writer and a coach that will attract the attention of an agent and a publisher." So, if you're ready to try something new and join a community of writers and book coaches helping writers, visit authoraccelerator.com/writing to learn more.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay.
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3.
KJ Delantonia, and this is #AmWriting, the weekly podcast about all things writing, short things, long things, fiction, nonfiction, pitches, proposals. This is the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done. I am solo this week, which most often means I am with a guest, and you are right if that is what you have guessed. I am here today with Maria Teresa Hart. She is a writer and editor who works most often in food and travel with a series of impressive bylines that range from the New York Times and the Atlantic to Vice and Business Insider. But she's here today to talk about the experience of writing a book for a publishing house within an existing series. Maria Teresa has written her first book, Doll, for Bloomsbury's Object Lessons series, and we're going to talk about how that happened, what it was like, and how an experience like that can be a doorway into larger opportunities in publishing. So welcome, and thanks for being here.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for that intro. I'm blushing over here. And can I just say, I am so thrilled, like beyond thrilled to be on this podcast. This was a podcast that kept me company many times during the pandemic. It was like the thing that I put on to go on long walks. So in my head, you and Jess and Serena are already like my best friends. And I'm just thrilled to bits that I'm here speaking with you.
I am so glad to have you. And it is always fun to have a listener. We know when we get a listener as a guest that also means the kind of things listeners want to hear about, which I adore. And also I share that. I have many imaginary close friends in my AirPods, and that's just fine. Really, sometimes they're better than the regular kind. You don't have to.
Yes. Well, they're definitely on call whenever you need them. So that's
I like
terrific.
That. I like that a lot. So you've written... This is your first book, and it's Doll, and it's a pop culture feminist critique of doll history and culture, from Raggedy Ann to Barbie to android sex dolls.
Yes.
But, you know, it's also, so it's part of this Bloomsbury series, which has other things, other objects, which people have studied, but it is very clearly your own book. And sometimes in a series, the publisher will reach out to agents and ask for authors to do something particular. We're going to get into that. But this one, I'm guessing you pitched yourself.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I pitched it. In fact, I like to say that I wanted to write not just a book, but an object lessons book. That was the goal. I mean, I'm flattering them, but it's the truth. When you're a writer and you've been working in this profession for a while, your friends and family are always like, "When are you going to write a book?" That's the question that comes up all the time. And I used to say, "Never. I don't think I have a book in me." I really didn't think that was going to be the path I went down.
Mm-hmm.
If you know the publishing industry, the way I did, I would look at the genres and I would say to myself, "Well, I don't have a life that's feels remarkable enough to do memoir, and I don't have this platform where I'm this unimpeachable authority or that I have the social media following for nonfiction, traditional nonfiction, and I've tinkered on novels and whatnot, but this was really something that I sort of felt like I don't think I have it in me to do this, and I don't think that I have what the publishing industry is looking for, and so I was really just completely fine with that. I loved writing my essays, and I loved doing these one-off pieces. And then I read Summer Brennan's like jewel of a book, High Heel, which is part of the Object Lessons series. And when I read her book, that was the first moment where I was like, I do want to write a book, and I want to write a book like this. I was very into the idea from the jump of doing a book like her book. But in all honesty, if you read our books side by side, you'd see exactly what you said. There's no formula or script to the series whatsoever. They're around the same length, and they have a cover that, you know, you'd be like, yes, they're both in the Object Lesson series. But her book has a completely different structure. She's written these little vignettes that are maybe around like 150, 200 words that get pulled together almost like pearls on a necklace. You know, they get pulled together into a chapter, and they're just flashes. And then they're kind of structured in an interesting way where it's almost like a maze where you're going through these little vignettes to get to the center. My book is not structured like that at all. I have different sections that relate to the messages that are encoded in Dolls for girls and for women. And so it's about, it touches on class and race and history and celebrity, which was a really fun section to get into. And I'd structured it with those big pieces, with a doll, a kind of doll, a doll that would characterize each of those elements for each of the sections. And then in between that, I had another element that kind of characterizes play. So I had these interstitials that were really brief, like just two pages that were, I call them play dates. And they're kind of taking the reader along on like an actual moment that you would have as a kid where you get together and play dolls, and you're having that sort of fantasy moment with a paper doll that connect as actual functional paper doll in the book. So that's kind of like a fun little bit.
It's really fun. So let's back up and go to, well, I want to talk about specifically how you got this gig, but I also wanted to talk just a little bit about how these series work and what other things that writers might find out there that were similar. I mean, the most obvious example is the Dummies books. Mm-hmm. Unlike what you've mentioned, they do tend to follow the same structure, but I've read a number of them. They're uniformly well-written, entertaining, and useful. You know, they fit the format, but they're voicey. You know, you can tell who you're dealing with there. And you said that Bloomsbury has another series like this.
Yes. 33 and a third. Yep. 33 and a third. That is their series so my series, which is Object Lessons, each book is pegged to a different object, and it's a deep dive on that object, not just what you would think about in terms of, oh, it's a rundown of dry history or something like that, but it really is about the culture and the significance of it in our society. And then 33 and a third is the other series for Bloomsbury that I'm very familiar with, which is, that's their music series. So every book is a different album. And those are also have a similar length to them. So they're almost like nonfiction novellas. They're pretty short. They tend to be under 200 pages or just around that sweet spot. And they are also, those books don't have like a prescriptive element to them either in terms of structure. So they also have really different approaches, and they're written by a variety of people. Some people, of course, are music critics, but other people are just folks that they have a career and they have a certain fascination with an album. And then I do believe there was another series that I think is no longer running, but it was a Princeton University series that's similar to these, where each of the titles was a food, and it was like a deep dive on a food. I don't believe that series is running anymore, but that's just to give you another example of like the types of series that are out there and the subjects that they cover.
Yeah, I should have looked up, I wish I had looked up a few others. I'll try to find some more to throw into the show notes, because there's a bunch of stuff like this. And a similar version of this exists in fiction, which are, they tend to be fandom books. So there's actually two kinds. There's the children's books, where you're writing within an existing children's series that may have existing characters, or it may just be a format that repeats, like, you know, a lot of chapter books come in very repeating formats. Or fandoms in fiction look for people to write for them, or sometimes people can pitch that. Now, usually those books take the form of work for hire, where you as the writer don't end up owning, well, you never end up owning your words as a writer, but as a work for hire, they pay you. You wrote it, they get the money that comes from there. I think that varies a little within fandom, because sometimes you get some pretty famous sci-fi writers doing that. But as a general rule, it's work for hire. Was that your experience with Bloomsbury with this?
So I had a more traditional publishing contract, which was, it was the flat fee on signing, the fee when the manuscript is turned in, and then the royalties. So yes, so it was a little bit more traditional than the work for hire type of contract, but I am familiar with that. And of course, all of my writing before this was that work for hire. So it is the, you just get that flat fee when you deliver your writing, and that's what it is.
So what was it about, I'm trying to just sort of get us through this the process, and also give listeners an idea of how they might pursue something like this themselves. So it sounds like you were a fan of this specific series.
Yes.
And you also have this very specific interest. So those things really, because it's not like you were like, what could I possibly write for these things?
I was a little like that. It's funny.
Yeah?
I did. Yes. So I will say, to start, I was just, you know, doing my freelance writing. I've had a career, as you mentioned, where I've just been writing essays and whatnot for different outlets. And I did know about The Object Lessons. They are not just a book series. They're also an essay series that is in The Atlantic. And so to kind of test myself, I did do two other series essays on different topics. They're not about dolls. One was about, it was about hair dryers, funnily enough. And the other one was about bidets. And I swear that bidet one went viral. Like, I feel like, when I die
the
on
bidet
my tombstone,
lady.
Yes, on my tombstone, they're going to have my name that just says Maria Teresa Hart. And then under that, it'll say she wrote about bidets. So I think that piece continues to bubble up, on social media all the time, but honestly, I'm proud of it. So I love it. But it is a very funny piece to be kind of like notorious for. But I really felt that was a good test, because with both of those subjects, I was like, you know, I've gotten to the end of this topic already. Like I did my essay. There's not a full book here, at least not for me. So I've kind of come to my conclusion, and I was casting around a little bit for another topic that could have been book length, especially after I read Summer's book. I was like, oh my gosh, I want to do this. What would my book be? And I was really mulling it over. And it's funny that it took me a while to come to the topic of doll. I knew that I wanted to do something that was within sort of the realm of feminine, like formative feminine objects.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was kind of thinking about it. But I do remember like having conversations with friends being like, what should I write about? And I had a friend that was like, you should do concrete. And I was like, I don't think I'm the concrete person.
That's been a perpetual interest.
Exactly.
Look at my concrete collection.
Exactly. But it is funny. I had kind of compartmentalized this portion of my life and this expertise that I didn't think about it for a little while, but I do have this odd expertise in dolls that started when I was very young. I love dolls like many other little kids do. And then my family moved to the DC area. So I started going to the Smithsonian just to play. And I realized, oh, there's antique dolls in the collection here. And that was my first light bulb moment that, oh, these aren't just toys. They're actually their history, and they're considered rare historical objects. So that led me down this path as a kid where I got like the blue book for doll values and I started stalking estate sales and going to doll conventions. I was like the youngest person there by decades. And so I had this whole entry into subculture that none of my other classmates cared about. They were all just sort of weirded out by this strange doll collection I had. But I was utterly fascinated, and it really did kind of take me down to this place where I had this strange expertise that I had forgotten all about because I box these things away. My partner actually doesn't even like dolls, so I have all these things like just literally boxed up. They're just, you know, in the closet. And so it took me a while to remember, like, oh yeah, this is a topic that not only can I write about, but it's very, very in depth. Mm-hmm. And so it had that richness. But yeah, I do want to kind of get back to your question about just sort of like, what's the entry point for this? Because although I had written those essays, I still submitted unsolicited, just like everyone else. I didn't have an agent. I actually still don't have an agent. Mm-hmm. And I didn't need one, to be honest. I mean, up until this point in my writing career, I haven't needed one. And this, the part of the thing that drew me to this project was that it is open to anyone. So you can just submit a proposal. I do believe that their website, anyone can go to the website. It's objectsobjectsobjects.com is their website. And they have a tab that you can click on that says write for us. Huh. And in that tab, there's a form that you fill out. And that's where you can make a proposal for either an essay or a book.
Wow, so that really this is unusual.
Yes, this is very unusual, but it is very democratic. It is very open to writers to submit. I will say that they tend to have windows where they review submissions. So, I mean, if you just picked a random Tuesday to submit something, it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll get an answer by Friday. You might be waiting for a while. But I know on social media, for example, right now, they've just announced, hey, we're going to go through a review process. So if you have those ideas, send them in. And that first form is more or less like a query letter. You really outline what it is that you want to put forward. And then if they're interested, then you move on to the next round. And that next round is the full book proposal.
Right.
And I did get kind of a cautionary tale at that point where they wrote back to me and they said, yes, yes, we want the full book proposal. But they did tell me that they only accept 5% of the book proposals, and 5% of those make it into the finished book.
Sure.
So I knew there was some stiff competition, and I was just like, all right, I'm just going to do my best, give it what I can.
I think 5% is way better odds than your average book proposal. I mean, I don't think it's sort of impossible to have numbers on that.
Yeah. I mean, that is a good way of looking at it. 5% maybe beating the odds. And I will say, since I'm familiar with 33 and a third, they operate much the same way. They have their own social media accounts, just mm-hmm. like Object Lessons, and they announce moments when they're going to look at book proposals. And then you would go ahead and submit during those windows of time. Otherwise, they're closed to submissions, but you don't need an agent to submit. You can go ahead and submit on your own. And they have series editors that work on them. And they review, they accept certain ones. You have to make sure, of course, that your particular topic isn't covered, mm-hmm. And that you have something fresh to add to the conversation. That's kind of how the submission process unfolds.
Wow, I was totally unaware of this. And I think had I seen your book in the bookstore, or when I see your book in the bookstore, I'm guessing it's going to reach two sets of readers. Hopefully more than that, but those that are interested in the topic and those that like this series.
Yeah. You know, I think it's very clever. Both of these series, they have a built-in audience. And that is part of the liberating thing. Not only is it liberating to write for this series because there's less gatekeeping, you don't have to have an agent, you can pursue it on your own, but also I think that they're far more open to writers that don't have these massive platforms because they know they do have that built-in audience. It's the fan of the series, it's the fan of the object or the album, and that is really going to be appealing. They have that audience there. That said, I will say, don't put in your book proposal, oh, people that like my object are the ones that are going to buy this book. You're definitely going to have to dig in a little more than that. But I mean, no one listening to this podcast would do that. But yes, but I do think that that is part of the cleverness. And definitely for 33 and a third, they're like music series, that the fandom for music is, mm-hmm. is off the charts, to use a pun. So I think that they're very clever in having positioned themselves that way.
So the proposal that you wrote, standard proposal, who you are, why you should write this book, who the audience is, comps. I don't know. You probably did need to do your regular comps, because it's not just, like you said, it's not just comps, other books in this series. It's comps, other books that, you know, look at the in particular, the feminist piece of this, I would guess, were your strongest comps, and the way the cultural indoctrination that is involved in these toys. I mean, you could do something similar about G.I. Joe. You could do something similar about little army figures, or construction trucks, or toy kitchens.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, toys are such a rich subject. So I do hope there's a few more that join the series that are just other toys. But yes, absolutely. I had to do a full book proposal, and I didn't lean very heavily into the series at all. I mean, I don't think I mentioned a single other title in the series as a comp title. They have that information. They know exactly like how things have sold in their series. And but I definitely positioned this book as being part of a larger conversation happening around exactly what you say, like pop culture feminism and other toys and other books that examine the toy culture. And so I really saw it as more fitting in with that. And I had comps that spoke to that aspect of things. And also, I will say, I think I have really benefited from just the timing of this book, because back when I wrote this, I was just writing about something I cared about. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that soon on the horizon, there would be a Barbie movie that was coming out. So like somewhere across the country, like Greta Gerwig was like working with Margot Robbie in some room or something, penciling the script for the Barbie movie. And here I am working on my manuscript. And so it's just very lucky that it feels like the cultural conversation for dolls is continuing. Mm-hmm. And also I see it bubbling up all the time with American Girl doll memes and whatnot. This is like something that just continues to fascinate people. But when I did my book proposal, I couldn't draw on any of that. So I just had to say, hey, this is the body of work that exists for this topic, and this is the type of reader I think I will reach.
And how long did it take from proposal to draft, and then from turning it in to them publishing it?
Yeah, so it was a fast timeline, actually. I have to say, it was about, I gave myself a year. And so I did about 6 months of really intense research. And I felt very lucky that, again, I actually had some mm-hmm. knowledge to draw on to begin with. So I didn't start from scratch, which was a huge relief. I already knew the books that I wanted to pull from. And I think, like many of us do, that maybe I'd been writing something, some version of this in my head for a little while. And so I did know what I wanted to go to, but I dove into the research really intensely, and then I did another intense 6 months of writing. And I will say, I mean, as my first book, writing anything this length, even though it's short for a nonfiction book, was super intimidating. I was very scared that I wasn't going to be able to put my butt in the chair, as they say. Mm-hmm. So like, I was just like, how do I keep my butt in the chair? How do I stay motivated to push through something this long? I haven't done it before. And I really had to think of it mentally as I'm just doing, the book has five sections, like overall, and then like a conclusion and an introduction. And I just thought, these are just essays for some outlet that I've been assigned. So it's six assignments. I will get each one done. And I really broke it down that way, where each one I would, you know, read to my writing group and go, I actually have a writing coach. And so I would take them to him and get his feedback. And so I really did try to workshop each one on its own and think of it that way. Because otherwise, I think if I thought of the full manuscript, it would have broken me. I would have just been too scared to even attempt it.
And then did you at some point have to sort of think about, well, okay, why would someone having read the first of these essays want to go on to the second and then get that in there?
Yeah. I mean, they do, each piece can sit on its own, which I think is actually quite good just in the sense of like, they can break apart okay as excerpts, mm-hmm. but yes, they do have to hang together as a whole. They do have to have a unified voice and perspective. So that's a, you know, when you step back after everything is done, you have to do a little bit of tweaking. But I do think that the moment that I had where I added the play dates, that was the thing that I think really connected things together far more smoothly, because that was a moment where it was one of those moments where I had written most of the book and I had a shower thought that was like, wait a second, this book is made of paper and all I need is paper to make a doll. So really the reader could be holding a doll in their hands and then I can have these playful moments with the reader, taking them through every scenario that you might have as a kid playing. And so once I had that idea and that clicked into place, I realized that can be the setup, that play date can be the setup for the next section. And that really gave like a unifying element to the entire book, so that each, and something that becomes expected for the reader too. They're like, oh, okay, here's the playful setup. And then here's the meaty deep dive into the actual subject behind that little, you know, and you could even make a game of like guessing, oh, this is what the next topic is going to be. Because when you read the setup, you're like, what's going on here? Like, what's this little game that we're setting up? And then you see what it's about.
I think it's so fascinating how the structure, like, you know, you have your book idea and you have, and this is true of nonfiction and fiction, you know, you even have maybe the plot or the whole, but then you're just sort of constantly moving the structure or the arc or the way that things link together. And it feels, every time feels like a fresh, it feels like, oh my God, I'm starting over, but you're not, because, you know, it's, anyway, I think that's pretty consistent.
Yeah.
Across any big writing project.
Yeah. And it is also kind of shocking to me now when I think about it, I'm like, gosh, that was a late stage idea that wasn't even in the book proposal. And now it feels like the whole thing hangs on that. Like, but it is one of those things, I think, when you're, I mean, I get very intense in my writing. So this really was my life for that whole like 6 month period that I was writing it. It was like, okay, you flip the switch on life. You're like, life off.
Yep.
Just going to be about being in the chair, doing the writing. And I definitely, when you're so immersed in it, and I feel like it starts to, it's those calm moments when you're just making a cup of tea or you're taking a shower or whatever it is that you're still writing in your brain and those ideas bubble up. And I don't think it would have come to me otherwise.
Right. That is perfect. So sort of the last question on the topic of moving into this kind of book world. You said you weren't particularly interested in writing a book, but now that you have, let's talk about how adding the words "is the author of the book," such and such, are going to add to your bio and open other doors. Are you seeing that already? Are you just feeling it?
I'm feeling it. I don't have the next book, you know, in my mind yet, although I'm toying with a couple of ideas.
I don't think it's just for books, though. I'm known for the books that I've written now, but I wrote a book in 2006 with Susan Straub about reading for babies, toddlers, and twos. And at this point, I have barely written, you know, I've written like things in the front of book in print magazines about the different kinds of baby foods that are eaten in different countries. You know, that's where I am. And when I met up with Susan and we paired up and she was the expert and I was the writer and we decided to do this, once we sold that, I became, you know, the author of the forthcoming book. And man, that, you put that on your query and it's like, oh, I mean, you've already got that to some extent because you have the Atlantic, the New York Times, and a lot of really big bylines. But I think that book really adds a sort of a seriousness that is hard to get.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Like, I feel like I found some little side door in the publishing industry where I'm like, oh, I thought you'd have to go through the front door. And like I said, there's a lot of gatekeeping involved with that. But no, it does feel like I've sort of jimmied a side door and I'm going in through that entrance. And I completely agree with you that I think it does feel a lot more possible now that I can put on that bio, on that query letter, hey, I'm the author of this book that's already out there in the world, and this is how it was received, and this is the attention it got, and then to be able to springboard off that to the next project feels very, very possible in a way that if I had gone in cold and just said, I have these bylines, but now I want to write this enormous tome mm-hmm. of a book, I think it would be far more of a struggle. And same thing too, like I think I could have found an agent before this moment and been, it would have been lovely. Like I would have had that person along for the ride for this whole thing. But now I feel like looking for an agent, there's a distinct advantage that I can say, I've published this book already. And so now I'm an even more enticing client for them too. Mm-hmm. So I think for all of those little reasons, it's great to have this, this be a little sidestep into the publishing world.
Yeah, I think it's exciting. I think it's going to work really well. All right, let's take a second and we're going to come back and talk about what we've been reading. All right, you first. What have you been reading lately?
So at the time that we're recording this, it's spooky season, and I love to read things that kind of get me in the mood. I had a stint in children's book publishing, actually. So I still have such a fondness for kids' books, and so I'm reading a middle grade book, novel. It's called The Witches of Willow Cove, and it's by Josh Roberts, and it's very sweet and spooky, which is a funny combo, but it works. And it feels like a classic kids' book in that old, almost old fashioned, but modern, up to date, mm-hmm. and wholesome in that way. That is, it's so much fun and so sweet. And so if you're kind of like want to get into that fall mood, I would recommend. And I do have another book. Kind of, it's an adult book though. It's not kids, but it's called How to Be Eaten by Maria Adelman. And it's another book that has a little bit of spookiness to it. So I think that's why I'm gravitating towards it right now. Mm-hmm. But it's about, has a funny premise where it's about the different women that are from Brothers Grimm style fairy tales that are all in a support group together. And so they are facing their traumas, their past traumas from their fairy tales.
That sounds super fun.
Yeah. And like supporting one another and talking and realizing that, hey, maybe they have a lot in common with all of this past trauma that they've been through. So I'm definitely looking forward to that one too. How about you?
Well, that reminds me, and I haven't read this yet, but I have read another book of his. That reminds me of Grady Hendrix's The Final Girl Support Group, which is about, the last girl standing in all the horror movies. And so it's sort of a similar vibe that I haven't read yet. I loved his The Southern Book Club's Guide to Vampire Slaying. Ooh. That was super fun. So, and then totally, like, spooky, witchy, glorious, but not scary, although, you know, kind of with like a tense moment at the end. I just read something called Small Town Big Magic. I don't remember the author, but it was cute and fun and like a sort of a perfect rainy weekend read that you finish up. You kind of, warning at the end, it's like everything that was happening has resolved, except that it's very clear there's another book. Because there's like one thing where you're like, well, we don't actually know who did that, but it doesn't matter. It's still a satisfying book in and of itself. So it's kind of a funny one because it's almost a little hard to classify because you don't usually get, it was very rom-com-y, but you don't usually get a rom-com with an ending like that that really requires the series thing. Which that's more of a different genre. So, but I don't know how it'll fly, but I enjoyed it.
That sounds so much fun. I can't wait to look that up. And then when we get to proper soup weather and you're like, want to be inside and cozy, that sounds perfect.
Yes. So where can listeners best find you besides finding your book, Doll, which comes out
November 3rd.
November 3rd. So either right before or right after y'all hear this. Where else do you hang out on social media?
Yes. So there is my website, mariateresahart.com. It's Teresa, T-E-R-E, not no H. So I'm there, and I'm also on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So that's, this is so funny, but I'm actually going to look at my handles because I'm like, they're really close to each other. So I just don't want to get the two of them confused. Mm-hmm. So anyway, this is my silliness, but one sec. So, okay. It's, for Twitter, it's, Marite, M-A-R-I-T-E, Heart. That's my handle, and it's my nickname. It's a mashup of Maria Teresa. And then for Instagram, it's Maria T Heart is the Instagram handle. And I do all kinds of fun doll stuff on there, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
I have a doll quiz going in case you want to test your knowledge. So definitely some cool stuff to check out.
I love it. Well, everyone follow Maria Teresa, and thank you all for joining us. Another episode of Hashtag AmWriting. We're having a great fall, sort of moving in and out, trying some different things. As you may know, we've been running some ride-alongs lately. So if you are a subscriber at the moment they've been open to all subscribers, but if you aren't going to know when the ride-alongs are, if you aren't on the list. So head over to amwritingpodcast.com to sign up for that and hear more. And that's it. So until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting Podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Listeners, if you're not following along with Jess on Instagram and TikTok, you should be, because she's killing it with advice on kids and addiction, and because she's learning things about Reels and TikTok that could apply to you too, and she'll be sharing more soon, so you're going to want to know what's been going on. Look for her on Instagram as @teacherleahy and on TikTok as @jessleahy.